felony. We got rid of his felony for him. And then when a young DA investigator came in and said in front of this judge, I mean, it was just this amazing moment. Johnny said, well, how long did it take you to find this card? He said, about 2 minutes. I went and looked in the B's, and there was Butler. So when the judge became aware that he didn't have to go after the FBI, he didn't have to go beyond the legal system to say that the government suppressed evidence about their own witness committing perjury, and they knew about it. That not, they not being the FBI, but being the people who prosecuted him, the case was over, because we had a judge who had incredible guts. You know?
What drove you through the difficult moments? What drove you and the team through the difficult moments? I mean, as I was scanning through some of the information, there were some moments where it was just tough. It was the pressure, the stress. How did you have those tough moments and then rebound from them? What did you use?
I think part of it was my friendship with Geronimo and the fact that he wouldn't give up. I mean, there was a man who they said, if you admit you did it, you get paroled. And he said, I'll die in prison before I'll admit I did something I didn't do. That bond with him and seeing that strength in him pushed me. And, you know, I'm not the brightest legal mind, but I have a lot of stubbornness, and I just refuse to give up. I mean, I just refuse to believe that we couldn't free an innocent man who was framed. And it just motivated me. You know, I'd like to say it was the political beliefs and, you know, all these things, but I think it was much more a personal bond to him and a personal attitude in me that I just couldn't believe all these people could not overturn an illegal conviction. I refused to stop, you know. And looking back, I mean, I never thought that way we would do it. It's just one thing led to another. But I think, you know, and Geronimo was the leader of the legal team. I mean, you got to be real. There's very few clients you could ever say that about. He was the leader of the legal team, certainly emotionally and morally. I mean, he just refused to stop.
Tell us something about Geronimo that most people don't know. Something that comes out of your friendship. Something that, you know, because we know the Geronimo we read about. We read the obituaries during his transition. But tell us something about Geronimo that cast him as something the rest of us can reach and touch.
A couple of things. His humanity, whether it be to the movement to oppress people, which he really felt. I mean, he felt this incredible bond to help people. But his humanity, I mean, people who know him well, they say, what do you remember most about him? This incredible smile. He always had this huge smile and warmth about him. And one of the things I remember when he had just gotten out for a year, and my youngest son and I went to Morgan City, and Rory was probably about 8. And Rory was just a very inquisitive, you know, cute young kid. And Geronimo said he wanted to run, and Rory had never run. And Rory said, I want to go. And Geronimo and him came back 2 hours later, and they had bonded, this little boy and this man were like friends, you know? And it wasn't fake. It was something, he found the joy in life. And it, you know, ultimately the joy in life is people. It's not, I mean, I hate to say it, I don't think it's, maybe we're motivated by movements and beliefs, but ultimately we get our joy from other human beings and helping them or being with them. And that was who he was. I mean, the way he bonded with my wife when she was dying, I mean, they had a connection. I mean, he got out a month before she died, and he came to my house and spent 5 days just sitting in this room with her. And he didn't have to do that. I mean, he had so many things to do in his life, you know, but he was connected to me and he was connected to her. And he spent 5 days just sitting with her, talking or not talking, just sitting with her, watching her. And that's the part, I mean, people don't understand his incredible humanity. And he never wanted to be a leader. He never wanted to give speeches. He never wanted to be, I mean, part of the problem when he got out, people wanted him to be something that they wanted. And he wanted to be who he wanted to be, which was this human being who cared deeply about a lot of issues, but dealt with them quietly and outside the limelight, whether it was in Africa or this Coogee Foundation he set up in Morgan City. That's the way he lived his life. It was very personable and human. And not, he didn't want the limelight. I mean, it's amazing, you know, he could have been in it, you know. I mean, it's amazing at Johnny Cochran's funeral, the main person with all these people speaking, people wanted to hear was Geronimo. I mean, it was really an amazing thing, but he was never comfortable that way.
You were a veteran, right?
Yes. It was the Vietnam War. And I had been to Senator Mangold with the conflict there in 65, briefly, and then back to Vietnam for the Tet Offensive in 68. after being sent to quell a rise in Detroit in 1967 with the 82nd Airborne Division. So my experiences were like packed in this short period of time, but it was very, very widespread. And that opened my eyes to a lot and educated me to a lot. At the time, I'm 19 years old, 18,
19
years old.
What was it like to be in Detroit?
It was hilarious. I mean, you know, at that time we were young because the government made this big mistake of sending an outfit who had just come from Vietnam and who were 60, maybe to 70% black. It was a huge mistake that the Pentagon had made in sending us to Coral Riot in 1967, almost within days after coming from Vietnam, and all of us were largely, primarily, we were combat vets. And so it was funny because it was a big party. Everybody in the community came and was glad to see us, like, because they know we supported what they were fighting for. So it turned out to be kind of a tit-for-tat thing with the Michigan National Guard and the various predominantly white forces that were sent in to quell the black rioters. And at some point, I think it was about a week and a half later, they realized the mistake they made and they pulled us all out. And the next thing you know, we were put on the transports back to Vietnam as a punishment for losing so many weapons and munitions while we were in Detroit. And that's how I got back to Vietnam. And that plane, it was, people were like almost about to hijack that plane because we had just come from Vietnam. We had just done a year in combat. You know, I had been wounded and it was like, hey. So when we landed in Da Nang the second time for the Tet Offensive, it was a plane load of angry soldiers that they let off that plane. Until I got out of there and a few months later, after Martin Luther King was killed, the United States made some big mistakes during that period. As it turned out, it was a big boon for the movement because it really radicalized a lot of people to doing the right thing.
You're listening there to the voice of Geronimo G. Jaga-Pratt. You're joining us this evening on Africa Day Transitions on Traditions, a special three-hour program honoring the lives of Geronimo G. Jaga and of Don Cox, the Field Marshal. I want to let you know that coming up, much thanks to the International Committee to Campaign to Free Geronimo G. Jaga, Leslie Taisha Phillips, Muja Shakir, Kiulu Inyasha, many other people to thank. And there are two events coming up. One coming up this Friday, July 15th, at the Eastside Arts Alliance Cultural Center, 2277 International Boulevard in Oakland. It's going to start at 6 p.m., sponsored by It's About Time, Party Legacy and Alumni, the Oakland Community School Alumni, family, friends, and comrades of Geronimo, the Commemoration Committee for the Black Panther Party, Eastside Arts Alliance, Friday, July 15th at 6 p.m. Also coming up, a big event on Sunday, July 17th at 2:30 p.m. at Bobby Hutton Park, Defermery Park, 18th and Adeline Street in Oakland. That's it. 2:30, all of these honoring and celebrating the life of Geronimo G. Jaga-Pratt. And there will be a program going on in East Africa on the 17th also with Pete and Charlie O'Neill honoring Geronimo G. Jaga-Pratt and many other freedom fighters. Take a moment here. Emory Douglas, the Minister of Culture of Black Panther Party, joins us in the studio. Emory, we wanted to make sure that we mention Reggie Major, the author of A Panther is a Black Cat. Say a few things about Reggie Major in our short break here.
Well, Reggie Major was a veteran of the struggle, and he was around very early on. He used to come up to Elgis when we used to work on the paper together out of Elgis' studio apartment before we even had a central headquarters. And he used to give a lot of information to Eldridge to put into the paper, a lot of research and other materials that he had during that time. And he would write from time to time for the paper. So Reggie was an early comrade in of ours in the struggle.
You know, Emory, one of the things that's been mentioned a couple of times in talking about Geronimo is his compassion for people, for other people. And you have a very special connection to that. When Geronimo was finally released from imprisonment, there was something special going on with Geronimo and your mom. Tell us about that.
Yes. While in prison, Dre used to call from time to time, and I wouldn't be at home, and he would talk to my mom. And they had she had a down-earth feeling to him, and so he enjoyed talking with her. He always asked about her and what have you. So when he got out of prison, he would come by when he had on his way through the Bay Area, and he would always stop by and ask how mom's was. And he would come in and gave a hug, give a big kiss, and talk with her. And even when he got out early days, he used to call and call and talk with her from time to time.
That went beyond just your connection as party members to more of a family brotherhood type.
Yes, absolutely. And the same thing happened with Amelia Ashley Ward, who was the founder owner of the Sun Reporter newspaper, because she allowed me to put the whole transcript of his trial in the paper. And so he would call and catch up with me from time to time to know if I was coming to visit. And he would talk with her. She had that same earthly kind of a feeling that he appreciated from being from the South. And so he when he came back, he greeted her and always asked about her as well.
Yeah. You know? The voice of Emory Douglas, our guest tonight here on Transitions on Traditions, Africa Today. Our special salute in memory to Don L. Cox and Geronimo Jijaga Pratt.
I mean, I could have escaped, but you charged me with a murder I didn't do. I'm not going nowhere until you clear it up. And I will tell you, I don't care. You know, that woman had a life. Mrs. Carolyn Olson had a life that was used like so many of us was used and expended, and her life was wasted by these vicious programs. And I wanted to know, I wanted the truth to come out, but I was in a hole. They put me in a hole for the first 8 years. No visits, they attacked me. All I wanted to do is expose the truth. Everything about the revolution, everything about everything else got to be on hold. I want to expose the truth that my mother did not raise a murderer. And don't put that on me. And that Mrs. Olson, we learned, was a very progressive person who was a part of the anti-war movement at the time. And strangely enough, she's dead, I'm in prison. What, something is not working here, you know? So I wanted to expose that. I didn't know about Nixon then. I didn't know about COINTELPRO then. But at the time, we did not know that Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover had plotted to kill and destroy one of the most beautiful movements that history has ever seen. And these sick individuals were allowed to get away with it. And when it was exposed, and I was in Folsom Prison facing sadistic guards who were shooting us with guns, while this was going on, Nixon is being exposed as a criminal. And later on, J. Edgar Hoover and all the rest of them. So it stands to reason if they're exposed as criminals and they're the ones who put us in prison, then we can't both be criminals. So I wondered, well, what's happening? But I'm in prison. We didn't have TVs and radios back then. We hardly got any mail. We hardly got any visits back during those years, those first 8 years in prison. It was strange that we went to San Quentin and he went to San Clemente. It didn't add up.
We're speaking with Harold Taylor, known as a member of the SF-8, former political prisoner and a victim of the government's COINTELPRO program. Speaking with him today about Geronimo Pratt and his personal connection to Geronimo. How are you doing today, Harold?
I'm doing just fine. And I want to say it's an honor and a pleasure to be with you guys today. Also, it's really an honor for me to have the opportunity to serve with Geronimo as a member of the Black Panther Party from 1967 up until to the early 70s.
Tell us about that time period. How did you and Geronimo first come into contact?
Well, we came into contact through our apprentice, Bunchy Carter. And I was in a section called Section 1A, which is on 84th and Broadway. And Geronimo was, at that time, I think he was one of, he was a captain in the party. And, he would make checks coming by the office and stuff, and we'd get together and, we'd talk about different things in political education classes and how to go about serving the community and meeting the needs of the community and putting some programs together. And just basically organizing, you know, within the community, organize the community against police brutality. Also organizing free breakfast programs, free health clinics, and whatnot, whatever was needed in the community, and doing registering people to vote, and also going door to door to get people's opinion about the Black Panther Party, what they see in the party, what they expect from the party. And we know we did quite a bit of stuff in basically cleaning up the neighborhood, our drug dealers and stuff like that. And just let them know that they couldn't sell drugs around churches and schools, and they were we eliminated burglaries in the neighborhood. We made sure that the elderly could go to the store without worrying about getting their purse snatched or being inside. And the kids can go to the park and play. It was a hectic time at the time, and I basically worked as an organizer from Los Angeles to San Diego. You know. Matter of fact, Geronimo, after Bunchy was assassinated, Geronimo gave me and Ronald Freeman an assignment to go to San Diego to reorganize that branch, because at the time John Savage was assassinated by members of the US organization, you know, which was everybody became a victim of COINTELPRO, and I worked in San Diego for about maybe a year, and ended up coming back to Los Angeles, and pretty soon after that, the split came about,
mm-hmm.
where COINTELPRO, the FBI, and CIA destroyed the Black Panther Party. And in the midst of that, Geronimo was arrested in Texas and brought back to California. I went to visit him in jail to see how he was doing and see what I can do with, on his defense committee. And in the midst of that, I was set up in a shooting incident.
Right.
With COINTELPRO, where we would attempt to assassinate me and two other brothers.
During the time that you and Geronimo were Panthers together,
mm-hmm.
you know, there were a lot of your comrades, your brothers and sisters, who were being murdered, who were being
right.
killed by government and other forces. And
right.
it takes a level of dedication to see that going on, yet remain steadfast to the work that needed to be done. For you and Geronimo and the other brothers and sisters, talk about that level of dedication. What kept you steadfast?
Me and Geronimo used to have this saying, I'm only loyal to those who are loyal to me, you know. And that was one of the basic principles we stood on, and the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party. Those are the principles of the party. These are the things that we all signed up for, you know, not literally signed up, but wanted to do. We wanted to escalate things in the community. We wanted to be a part of the community and protect the community. It's the love of the people that really inspired me to do a lot of things. You know, I talked to Geronimo prior to him going to prison. In a county jail, we were in this particular lockup where they had political prisoners, and there was only 8 of us in there on a whole cell block. And we talked quite a bit because we had plenty of time to do it. That was before Geronimo went to prison. And we've had these long conversations about what was needed to be done and what could be done. And we continued to work on those things as we got out, as I got out, and I continued to work with it. And Geronimo went to prison, but at the same time, I remember many conversations we had, even conversations concerning Geronimo's case, where the two people that killed those people in the tennis court, I happened to know who they were at the time, and they both were dead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they were my people from my particular section that turned renegade and began to become burglars and robbers, you know, before the split in the party. They left the party. And I told Geronimo in my own words to him that you don't have to go to prison. I know who did it. I testified. But he said he didn't want me to do that, that him and Johnny Cochran had everything under control, and he didn't know that they were sabotaging his defense committee and they had spies in it. And that's how Geronimo ended up in prison. I had a visit maybe 15 years ago from an investigator, came here from guy named John McCloskey. He was investigating Geronimo's case, and I gave him the story. And so happens that he had already talked to one of the other members in my section that was there named Tyrone Hutchison. And Tyrone told him the identical story that I told him, and I hadn't seen Tyrone in 30 years. I understand why Geronimo was in prison for so long, but at the same time, it was a great injustice. And there's still political prisoners. Well, man, Chip Fitzgerald, he's still in prison since 1969. He's another comrade from Los Angeles. Being a political prisoner, being a revolutionary is a life sentence. That's what you're going to be, whether you want to be it or not, the rest of your life.
When you and Geronimo met as Panthers, what was that like, and what was it like for you working with Geronimo? What did you see in him that you knew this was a brother that you can work with and rely on?
What really happened with me and Geronimo is we had some constructive arguments, you know, disagreements, but criticism was always in the equation. We had to, in order to shape different people in the party, being good community workers and dedicated workers, yet we established criticism. And Geronimo, he had a red GTO. And I used to criticize him about that GTO, that we needed to have that car so that we could sell that car and we could house some more people in the community, Panthers, because we all did a lot of living together. And Geronimo eventually did that. You know, he felt that need for it. He had bought that car when he got out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably one of the biggest things he ever had, but he soon gave it up for the community. You know, and I thought that was a real great thing about it. And also, me and Geronimo never just agreed on everything. There was always this thing between me and him where we would always challenge each other. But we basically were challenging each other to do better and to do more.
Right.
You know. And it worked out really nice. We turned out to be good friends on that. And he was always with Bunchy. And we used to have some meetings together where it was just a certain group of us. And we would talk about strategy and tactics in the community. And Geronimo had good ideas. You know, after all, Geronimo is the cause of all those brothers and sisters that was in that office on 41st and Central. After 5 hours of shooting out with the police, it was Geronimo's design of that office that saved their lives.
Mm.
And I talked to any of them that wouldn't say that in a heartbeat, you know. And all of them recognized the fact that for 5 hours they understood true freedom because they were attacked by the enemy and they were able to repel them, to hold them off, but nobody died. And that's unheard of, and that was the beginning of SWAT. SWAT was born in Los Angeles, and it was born and designed to oppress and suppress members of the Black Panther Party. I've been shot 6 times by the LAPD, and I'm locked up the whole 2 years on a case that charged me with 6 counts of attempted murder on the police. And I was acquitted of all charges. And at that time, they promised me that it's not over and there will be back. I'm glad that you give me a chance to say these things about Geronimo because we're gonna miss him and you're not gonna see many more soldiers like Elmer Pratt. But Geronimo was a special soldier and he was a good soldier. He come out of the mold of Bunchy Carter. He was a lot like Bunchy because one Bunchy kept him under his wing so tight. And Bunchy suffered from COINTELPRO along with John Huggins, Fred Hampton, John Savage, Sylvester Bell, these are all comrades that I broke bread with, and I've been around them, and we've had these talks, you know. And we always suspected there was a bigger element involved, but we just never could put our fingers on it. But we knew it wasn't just the local police, because too many different strange things was taking place.
Well, Harold, I want to thank you for taking the time to share the memories, your personal memories of Geronimo Pratt, and thanking you for the work that you've put in also as a freedom fighter and the work that you continue to do.
My love to the Bay Area. Love you guys.
It is indeed a pleasure and an honor to welcome to this program, to these airwaves, Shona Pratt, the daughter of Geronimo Jijaga Pratt. Shona, welcome to KPFA.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As I mentioned, so many people know of Geronimo, the freedom fighter, the Black Panther, the political prisoner. But we'd like to know, Geronimo, more of the family side. Your father was actually in prison when you were born.
That is correct. When I was born in 1979, he had been locked up for some years already. But he and my mother were very excited about me coming, and but I was conceived actually in San Quentin, and spent most of my childhood in San Quentin visiting him.
Tell us about those early years that you remember visiting him. What was that like for you? Since initially that was what you knew of your father, where he was.
Right. Initially, it seemed normal. You know, it didn't seem conventional, of course, because it wasn't, you know, he wasn't home to experience everyday life with me. But going to visit him weekly, sometimes even daily, I have to say, looking back in hindsight, I really believe that we had that was our family time. You know, my brother and I, my mother and my father, we sat at a table, we discussed what happened, you know, in our daily lives with each other. We included him as much as we could, and we really had that family unit, even though he was behind bars.
What was the relationship like between you and your dad? How were you able to build a solid relationship with him incarcerated?
My father and I had a really close relationship growing up. I'd have to say I was the closest. We were more alike, meaning we always talked, and we would kind of take over the visits. I would speak about my experiences at school, and he would tell me about his. I really don't know how to explain it except to say that we were just on one accord, even though he wasn't there. There were times when I would ask my mother, could I go certain places, or can I go here, go there, and I would have to wait until he called on the phone, and I had to include him. He was very much included, and so we couldn't help but have a close relationship, and I'm definitely a talker like he is, so I think I kind of took over the visits and made my, you know, that was my stage, and Dad always listened, and he was always there to kind of give some support or give his own experience of when he was a child. And so we were very, very close.
It sounds like to some degree that even though he wasn't physically in your home, that he was still able to lay down a parental foundation.
Oh, yes, very much so. Very much so. And sometimes my mom would be more of the disciplinarian sometimes because she was there,
right.
You know, so, but we had to run everything. So there was nothing that happened that Dad didn't know about. And I mean, that was from either, you know, from things that I wanted to share. And then as a parent as well, my mother told him just about everything that we went through. So yes, he was a very, very much included, in parenting us growing up.
Your times together, what were those like?
Our times together were filled with stories, filled with dreams, filled with hopes. We always dreamed that we would travel the world. My father, it was very important to him for his children to be well-traveled so we can have a better understanding of what was going on in this world, you know, not just here in the United States, but in the world. And I think him sharing his stories and his experiences of when he was a child and also when he was in the war, you know, and a little bit of his experiences as a member of the Black Panther Party. Now I really feel as though I really would, I'd like to take that on, you know, because I know that he really wanted us to be well-rounded and well-educated and well-traveled.
What were some of the other things that you gained from your father? I mean, this was a man who spent time fighting for the rights and freedoms of others. And from speaking with other people, your father was definitely selfless in this act.
Oh, yeah.
What are some of the things that you gained from him or that you learned from him or that he told you about freedom fighting, about standing up for others?
Right. Well, I agree wholeheartedly. Both my parents were freedom fighters, and they, I believe it led me to have a natural tendency just to be, you know, of service to those less fortunate than myself, and just to be, you know, when I see injustice, or when, you know, there are certain things that happens to children or to women, and it breaks my heart, and to always just respond and try to correct as much as we can to fight injustice. That has to be a big one for me and my life lessons with both of my parents, actually. And my father was a freedom fighter. You know, I think a lot of people do think because it was, you know, he was a leader, one of the leaders of the Black Panther movement, and it was about the black power, and it was, but it was injustice anywhere within any culture, you know, and I definitely have that. It's just within, you know, whenever I see it, I try to do whatever I can, and that's definitely my father within me. It's still there, very strong, and it also gives me some comfort, especially now.
What was it like for you and your siblings as you were growing?
It came in spurts. But when I really realized it is when I had my own child, I believe. I didn't really get when he said he stayed in the hole for 8 years. I don't even think I had a clear meaning of what that meant. You know, I didn't know in a hole literally for 8 long years, you know, with not being out to be among, you know, regular population. And I think at that point when I learned that, I just felt a tremendous sense of pride, because not too many people can do that and still be sane, right? You know, or not judgmental. He wasn't bitter at all. He wasn't angry. He accepted it as it was. He handled his situation the best way I feel any man could handle it. And I think that when I really learned of his efforts in our community, I just felt a real sense of pride. But at the same time, you know, not having him there for certain things of, you know, like when a young girl goes on her first date, or
right.
I think there are certain things that I missed out on not having him there physically. And, you know, I had a daughter at 17 years old, you know, and because of the foundation that I came from, and because my parents were really supportive and really just had a really strong foundation, I was able to still graduate from high school. I was able to take care of my daughter. My daughter's doing extremely well. She's been accepted to one of the most prestigious high schools in the Bay Area, and, you know, she's on her way into high school. My father absolutely adored her, and I mean, we definitely turned all of our negatives into a positive, and that was also something that we learned from him. But we were definitely affected by the negative.
Shauna, you mentioned you have a daughter, and your dad adored her. Talk about that relationship.
Oh, I had my daughter was about 6 months when my dad was exonerated, and he absolutely loved her. I think my daughter gave him the opportunity to experience how to be a parent, almost, because he missed out on so much of my brother and I's upbringing in physically being there. He often sometimes, her name is Ashaki, she's named after my mother,
mm-hmm.
and he would often refer to her as Shauna. Very, very often, she'd run around and he'd say, Shauna, you know, because I believe he really wanted to be there, and he missed out. And, you know, quite frankly, she just looks just like me. So it was very hard for him. But he took her everywhere. He would go running in the Bay Area, sometimes at Mount Tam around the track, and he took her, and they'd be on. He got a bike, and he'd put her on the back, and he just wanted to show her everything and show her the world. He literally took her on almost as his own. Even up to the last month of him being here and we visited, he spoke to her about a boat that he purchased and named the boat Baby Ashaki, and how he would take her out and, you know, explore the swamps. and she didn't remember much of it because, you know, she's 14 now and all this was going on when she was 1 and 3, but he absolutely adored her and she loved him. She loved him. He definitely took on that grandpa father role,
right,
in her life. And at that time, she was just completely in awe, and so was he. It was something really, really nice to see.
Now, looking back, Shona, on your childhood and that of your siblings, a lot of times we read about children who have parents who are in the spotlight in a certain way. And because those parents have to give so much of themselves for others, the children may feel some sense of not having enough or some sense of resentment to that. Was there ever any resentment with you and your siblings because your dad wasn't there, because he had given so much of himself for others?
I've never spoke to my sister or my brother about that, but I do know personally I did. And like I said, the more I understood, you know, the better I became with this whole situation. But I did feel like it was hard.
Share a personal memory of your father that you would like for the public to share in with you.
My father used to, when he was released from prison, I guess this one is a funny one, he was inundated with calls, and I used to always joke with him and say, "You think you're so important, don't you?" You know, and he'd say, and he'd just laugh because he'd think it was funny, because he never looked at it that way. He never wanted to be, you know, he never liked the media attention so much. He just wanted to uplift his people and share the knowledge that he had, so he can so we can take it on and do something more. And something just this past time when I visited him about a month before he passed, we had a talk, a long, long talk about our upbringing and things that we've gone through. And I told him, and at the end of the conversation, I said, so I guess you are very important. And he said, not as important as you. And I just, you know, then I laughed it off, but now it takes a whole new meaning. You know, it just, so from back in 97, 96, when I kept telling him then that he wasn't important, joking with him, and it coming full circle, and him telling me, you know, no, but you are. And it really makes me feel like, you know, his legacy does live within us, and his children, and within all who knew and loved him. Because everybody has done something who knew and loved him. They were in the fight to help free my father, to help free Mumia, to help free all political prisoners. And I think as long as we continue to fight injustice wherever we see it, his legacy will continue to be there and live on through all of us.
So all power to the people.
All power to the people. The struggle continues. Thank you so much for putting on this show. I really appreciate it. And all of the people who are contributing, speaking, thank you very much from our family. We really do appreciate it, and look forward to many, many more.
Shona,
we're not done.
Well, we definitely want to thank you for taking the time out to share these personal memories of your father, and for the work that you, your family, and everyone connected to your father continues to do.
Anything else you want to add?
Just keep on struggling, keep on pushing. Remember the old quote from Curtis Mayfield under Impressions: be wary of educated fools from uneducated schools. Oh, Curtis.
You've been tuned in listening to a special program, thankfully, given the opportunity to honor the lives of Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt, Don Cox. We've talked about Michael Cetewayo Tabor. We've talked about Reggie Major. I want to thank Claude Marks of Freedom Archives, who Michael Yoshida, KPFA, who's without their help, it would not have been possible. You can go to www.freedomarchives.org. There's some audio there, some video of Geronimo. Certainly want to thank the families, family of Don Cox, Geronimo G. Hiraga Pat. Want to thank our sister, Kiyulu and Yasha. We want to thank Malcolm X Grassroots. We want to thank the Black Panther Party, Eastside Arts Alliance. It's About Time, Billy X. We want to thank Jill Sophia Elijah. We want to thank Taisha. Also want to thank Cheyenne Bell. May she rest in peace. And Mooja Shakir. Want to thank Carrie Kaur from KPFA, Pacifica Archives. We want to thank Reggie Major in memoriam. And then we want to thank all the people who've been fighting for freedom and continue to fight for freedom. As we mentioned, there's two events coming up. One is on the 15th of July at the Eastside Arts Alliance at 6 p.m., 2277 International Boulevard in Oakland. For information, give a call, 916-455-0900, or check out Eastside Arts Alliance. And coming up Sunday, July 17th at 2:30 p.m., Bobby Hutton, Lil Bobby Hutton, DeFermery Park, 18th and Adeline Street in Oakland, special program honoring the life of Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt and all political prisoners. We still have with us Claude Marks in studio, Greg Bridges, the host of Transitions on Traditions, and we also have Emory Douglas in the studio. And, you know, Emory, as we're getting here with our, it's a moving program. The work of Geronimo, the work of D.C., and they talk about the fact that they're still political prisoners. Shona mentions that. Your thoughts on, and Kathleen talked about, the best ways to organize, and what we should have gotten or what we need to have gotten from these years of people like Geronimo and D.C.?
Well, I mean, we should understand that we have to transcend all the ideological and philosophical differences in order to come together in regards to trying to make the effort, a strong effort, in regards to freeing political prisoners who was still locked up from the 1960s, 40, 50 years ago, mm-hmm. today.
What can we as a community do to bring more attention to the public on these other political prisoners and any actions that we can take to, you know, to bring more light to their plight?
Well, we have to participate in the different and educate and inform ourselves, enlighten ourselves about the issues, and be outspoken about them. Be fearless in relationship to you, and have a conviction in relationship to freeing and talking on these issues, mm-hmm. In the way that one may communicate it on that level or in that way. But it's something that has to be done, and has to be done in all aspects and all nicks and crooks and crannies of institutions in this country. We have to not just speak to the choir, but we have to speak and educate and enlighten those who are not informed and enlightened.
One of the themes that has run through this with hearing the voice of Don Cox, hearing the voice of Geronimo and the people that spoke about each of them, is that this struggle, the fight continues. What do we do now?
What do we do now?
What do we do now? How do we
That's something that has to be done now. That's something that has to come out of the discussions, out of the debates, out of the coming together and making decisions, hard decisions on what needs to be done now. So that's the process. It always evolves around coming and brainstorming, working with like-minded folks in relationship to putting forth the what we can do now.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was an interesting comment when D.C. was saying he was at the meeting where they formed the Central Committee, and he asked Bobby Seale, he said, well, what do we do? What do I do? Now I'm the field marshal. And Bobby said to him, well, if you see something that needs to be done, you do it.
Yes.
D.C. said he went on from there. You know, I was thinking...
The same thing Bunchy said. Bunchy said, you got to do something. You don't do nothing but spit.
If you don't do anything but spit. That's from the poem that Bunchy did. Yeah. But, Emory, with your with your art and with your cultural work, you've done some images for the San Francisco Age. You've done some things about Geronimo. How have you been bridging 1960, 1970, what you're doing now? What kind of voices are you trying to bring out in young people? And I know you've traveled and been in different communities in different parts of the world.
Well, I basically try to show them to be inspired. They can't duplicate what I did, but to be inspired by it and to evolve and develop from here and now in, on what was done, and to enlighten them, to educate them about what we were doing in relationship to political prisoners, and showing them in the context of art is not, you know, have to be for art's sake, but it can have very relevant meaning to the politics that are of today, and to maybe to communicate it in a language in a way that even a child can understand it.
You were really good at that as an artist, as connecting art to the politics of the day. And was that actually your beginning as an, I mean, the beginning of your public exposure as an artist, the art as politics?
In relationship to being able to communicate in that way, I think it maybe came from that first background at City College, but being involved in the Black Panther Party, where there were politics going on 24/7, 365 days a year, you begin to internalize it, and when you got people who can speak on an intellectual to a grassroots level, and you begin to get that sense of and how to apply. In reflecting your art, the things that being discussed and the challenges that we're confronted with, and also being able to tell our story from our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as you listen to the voices of people like Barbara Cox and Shona, and I wanted you to say something here about DC and about Geronimo, but you know, you saw these brothers and sisters, black leather coat, powder blue shirt, combat boots, and there was one image, and that was the image that was often fed to us. But I mean, listening to these voices, there's such a mix of just family and compassion and just down-to-earth kind of community people. It just seems like there's something very, very special about these brothers and about that period.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the qualities, they brought these qualities into the Black Panther Party. It wasn't like something that evolved out of the Black Panther. It was something that became a part of the Black Panther Party. It was that spirit that they had when they came in many ways, a family, a compassion, of love and respect, and a conviction to dealing with human rights violations and what have you. So that was strong conviction that they brought in to the party, but at the same time, when they brought it in, those who were maybe on wavering in those kinds of circumstances were able to reinforce and be inspired by them.
How did you make it through the tough periods, Emory? What did you? I mean, I know that's it's not like it was last week, but how did you make it through the tough periods where there was subterfuge and COINTELPRO and people lost their lives and people went to jail and there was a funeral? And how did you make it through the tough period?
It was conviction and commitment to the fact that, you know, that what you were doing was greater than yourself, and that you see that in relationship to how the community responded in spite of the COINTELPRO. People still were inspired by what we were doing. So it was knowing that there were people who beyond this was greater than yourself.
You know, when I was speaking with Harold Taylor, one of the things that I asked him was about how he is how he's able to continue the work. I mean, you know, you, Harold, Geronimo, DC, you guys have put in work for years. You're continuing to put, I mean, I see you around the community all the time. You continue putting in your community work. What is it that keeps you so committed? I mean, that, you know, some people may look at it as you've reached the point where you could say, okay, I've done what I can do. Now it's on y'all to do it. But what is it that keeps you committed and keeps you marching on?
Well, it's young people. Taken up the mantle and want to, who have been inspired and want you to come and participate and share with them in relationship to what your involvement was, and so that is that keeps the light, the spark, burning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Emery and Greg and Claude and the listeners, we want to thank you so much for being here this evening to take time to honor the lives of the Field Marshal. That's why everybody talked to him, Field Marshal D.C. and Geronimo Giraga Pat and all the other brothers and sisters and people around the world, whoever shapes and colors they may come in, who've stood as freedom fighters. And really, really appreciate you being part of this special evening.
That's an honor and pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much, Emery.
Thank you, brother.